Hi, I'm Brian Pearson. This is The Mystic Cave.
We were born before the wind. Also younger than the sun. And our modern boat was one as we sailed into the Mystic. Hark now, hear
the Mystic Cave is a sanctuary for the seeker. Stories, conversations, and reflections about the spiritual journey on the other side of churchland. Through the summer months, I'm offering something a little lighter than our usual fare. This is because I need to take a break from producing a weekly program, and because you might enjoy some summertime storytelling to take with you onto the back deck or out on a road trip. Each week I'll be reading from How the Light Gets In, a collection of my short stories published by the Anglican Book Center back in 1999. Despite my urge to do some major rewriting, I've tried to leave these stories pretty much as they were, except where I couldn't help myself. I'll release two stories a week, one on Sunday and one on Thursday. If you don't want to miss a story, be sure to subscribe on whatever format you use for your podcasts. And while you're at it, give the podcast a rating. That helps spread the word. I hope you enjoy these homespun tales as we all take our summer sun. Country Kitchens. A snowy eiderdown settled on the house last night as we slept. You could tell the moment you awoke. There wasn't a sound, just the dull, far-off drone of the furnace. The last few flakes were still falling as I stood with my coffee at the front window. On mornings like this, I make oatmeal for the family. Someday, they will thank me. I lace it to make it more palatable for them, a little salt for zest, bran for texture, maple syrup for taste. Of course, to them, it's still oatmeal. But to me, it's food for the soul. It's hot in your mouth and warm going down. It sticks to your ribs, as my grandmother used to say, though it doesn't have the same effect when I repeat this to my children. What an extravagant world God has made. A world you can not only touch and see and smell and hear, but also taste. It's no accident that Jesus, wanting to leave a sign for his disciples, left them a meal, warm bread fried in the pan, and sweet wine. He knew what he was doing. This was no cerebral love, as if his chief accomplishment on the cross would be an improved concept. It was an embodied love, as good for the body as for the soul. In divinity school, they taught us all we needed to know about the Eucharist, the worship ritual that evolved from the Last Supper. In a series of non-credit courses taught by the dean, we learned how to chant, a course we called deansing, how to enunciate properly, deanspeak, and how to preside at the holy mysteries, priestcraft. We folded our hands together and tucked in our thumbs. We raised our arms, but not too high, to hold the prayers of the people. We held one hand to the heart while making the sign of the cross with the other, fingers straight, thumb out of sight, slicing the air, not waving to the people. But I didn't learn a thing about the importance of meals until my first parish. The parish of St. Jude's is in farming country, dairy farming. People there are not sentimental about food. How could they be when they eat what they raise, including Bessie and Ferdinand? They eat to get the job done. But if they're not sentimental about food, neither do they take it lightly. A potluck supper is a minefield for a new minister. Two 8-foot-long folding tables joined end to end, adorned with a plastic gingham runner crammed with offerings from every kitchen in the parish. Casseroles and lasagna and jelly mold salads and cake and pie and fruit bread. The natural temptation is to overdo it. I once piled my plate high with a sample from every dish. When I had worked my way to the bottom and felt ready to explode, I still had one helping of lasagna left. I placed a paper napkin over it and gave it a heave under the sink. 2 years later, Flo Templeton got mad at me about a sermon or something, and then added the zinger. "Besides," she said, her pointed finger shaking with rage, "I saw what you did, how you chose my lasagna from all the others and threw it in the waste bin. You think I didn't see, but I did." Years later, I'm still trying to come up with a response. I learned early on that an unannounced parish visit around 4 in the afternoon led to roast beef and mashed potatoes just as surely as the new day led to morning chores. It would have caused offense to rebuff their hospitality, especially when they insisted it was just one more potato in the pot. It was also true, of course, that the pastoral call in the strictest sense lost some of its focus around the big kitchen table. This was not a time for conversation. It was a time to pass the peas, pass the butter, pass the corn, pass the pie. Had I missed the secret of the country kitchen, I would have missed the heartbeat of my congregation. This is not a secret you learn by calling ahead and making an appointment as they do in the city. A formal pastoral call in a rural parish never gets you to the kitchen. You might pass by the dining room, the hub of the farming operation, the table piled high with bills and papers, with a calculator and now, likely, a computer. But they take you instead to the front room, a formal parlor they never use themselves. It is a room reserved for clergy and for undertakers. Lounging awkwardly in an antique straight-backed chair, trying to look casual, you make conversation. You ask how the farming's going. "It's fine, thank you, but no one knows what'll happen tomorrow." You ask about the photographs on the piano. You get names and family connections. Someone plays hockey. Someone else has gone off to college. As the ticking of the clock between the long silences announces that a mere 20 minutes has passed, you slap your knee and say you should be on your way. Your hostess is stunned. "So soon? She's made blackcurrant sweet tarts for you. Please, you must stay. She'll just go and reboil the kettle and make some tea. It won't take a minute." It takes more than a minute. You realize you have violated some unspoken rule, like a proper pastoral visit in these parts never takes less than an hour, and the tea is served at 45 minutes. These are hard things for a city-bred boy to learn. But mealtime in the country is different. One of my first country meals was at the home of my neighbors, the Browns. They were in their 70s, living in town and enjoying the simple pleasures of retirement. Alf had spent much of his life farming, though he never owned a farm of his own. For the last 10 years, he had been custodian at the district high school. Theirs had not been an easy life, but Ina had managed to put something away every year, even while they were raising their children, so that now they owned their own home and were able to live comfortably, happily active in the church and in the busy affairs of the community. It was my second or third week in the parish, and Ina invited me over for their noonday meal following church on Sunday. I would have to keep my eye on the clock, as I had arranged a visit with Daisy Youngman later that afternoon, but I accepted her invitation and looked forward to their hospitality. I was not disappointed. While Ina made preparations in the kitchen, Alf brought out his accordion. I sat at the piano, and together we muddled our way through a few old hymns and war songs. He began telling me stories from the war, which I could have heard all day, but then Ina called us to the table. She had set out her finest bone china. Alf and I took our places, and Ina re-emerged from the kitchen with a roast chicken, arranged on a platter with roasted potatoes and carrots. More serving dishes arrived: peas, mashed potatoes, gravy, celery, olives, buns, and butter. We shared stories, mine sounding so slight and insubstantial beside theirs. Alf had been one of Dr. Bernardo's home children, orphans taken from the streets and orphanages of pre-war England and sent out to adoptive households throughout the Commonwealth. Most of the children became little more than indentured servants, working for their room and board until they were old enough to break free and start a life of their own. Alf had been taken in by the Whittakers, who had a dairy farm south of town. He had grown up alongside Earl Whittaker, who was his own age and who might have been like a brother to Alf had old Mr. Whittaker allowed it. Instead, Alf did chores where the family sat down to eat, taking his meals alone after they were done. I had seconds and thirds of everything. I pushed my chair back from the table, but then Ina brought out a freshly baked peach pie, serving up huge slabs for Alf and me with double dollops of vanilla ice cream. I was slowing down, a sleepy haze descending on me as Alf wondered aloud about kids nowadays and old world values and other things he just couldn't understand. Back in the living room again, over cups of tea and biscuits with cheese, Ina offered me measured advice about St. Jude's. There were people, good, well-meaning people, mind you, but people I ought to be wary of, some who would be nice to my face but then cause trouble behind my back, others who would try to run things their own way. But I was their new minister. I should do what I thought was right. She and Alf would support me. I took my leave about 3 o'clock, feeling bloated and drowsy, all but rolling down the road to Daisy Youngman's house. I had not met Daisy before. She was elderly and, I understood, infirm. She could no longer make it out to church, but several people had told me it would be important for me to call on her. I arrived and rang the bell. After a few moments, I could hear the shuffle thump of a walker making its way to the door. Daisy was indeed old, her body badly hunched over. Yet her eyes shone as she greeted me. She had me sit in the parlor while she got a few things ready in the kitchen. She asked me to pour myself a glass of sherry from a decanter that had been placed on a TV table beside the chair. I asked if there was anything I could do to help, but she was clearly determined to serve me. I sipped at the sherry, taking in the details of the room. Her daughter was Reeve of the town, but there was no indication of that here. Instead, there were pictures of grandchildren, a display of birthday cards, some framed needle points, and doilies everywhere. The room was warm. I could feel myself slowly sinking deeper, deeper into the chair. Daisy was speaking to me from the doorway. I awoke with a jolt. She was inviting me into the kitchen. Rising unsteadily, I could smell something cooking. Two places were set at the kitchen table. She insisted I be seated. And then, making her way over to the oven, she bent over, opened the oven door, and produced a triumphant platter. Roast chicken with carrots and potatoes. I got up and helped bring the meal to the table, holding her chair as she sat down opposite my place. She looked exhausted. She said she didn't have much of an appetite herself, but she had raised 3 children, and she knew how to feed them. So would I please say a blessing and then go ahead myself? Sometimes people have asked my opinion. Should they take communion twice the same day, as when someone is server at the early Eucharist and then returns with their family later for the main service? They have heard it said it is an abuse of the sacrament to receive it more than once. For me, the matter is fairly simple. Do you eat more than 3 meals a day? Not without regretting it. But if, after you have had your own dinner, you should drop in at a neighbor's house and they ask you to join them out on the porch for a cup of coffee, you would not refuse the invitation. You take the coffee, and maybe a piece of cake, too. Not because you need it, but because it is the right thing to do. It honors your friendship. So also with God's grace. Will I refuse the costly gift of Christ's body and blood because it is more than I need, indeed, more than I will ever need? Do I decline the offer, saying, "That's awfully kind of you. You really have gone to a lot of trouble, but I've already eaten. Perhaps some other time." No. I ate the chicken. I stuffed down the roast potatoes. I helped myself to the carrots and the gravy. And then, when Daisy toddled back to the counter and removed a tea towel from a freshly baked peach pie, I exclaimed that no one could turn down such a lovely pie as that. I passed on the ice cream, though. Daisy died several months later. I went to see her as she lay in the hospital. She was rolled up in a fetal position, unrecognizable, her hands curling in on themselves. She tried to acknowledge me with her eyes, but even that seemed to be a strain. I sat beside her a while, uncertain how you visit someone who can't speak. She didn't want small talk, and I didn't know how to initiate a one-sided conversation about death and dying, so I just sat, feeling young and foolish. At last, I heard a sound. She was looking at me. I leaned in closer. She breathed some words. I couldn't make them out. I concentrated as she tried again, but I still couldn't get it. I apologized to her. Then she mouthed very distinctly, "The Lord's my shepherd." I smiled with recognition. I took her hand and began reciting the lines I thought were indelibly written in my memory. "The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures and leads me beside still waters. He revives my soul and leads me beside still waters. He makes me lie down." I was getting dizzy. He makes me. I withdrew my hand, frantically trying to remember how it went. Then I felt the touch of her withered fingers on my arm. "He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness," she whispered, her eyes beaming, "even for his own name's sake." Then she recited the whole damn thing. "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil, my cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever." The whole time, she never took her eyes off me. For years I couldn't tell that story. Pride prevented it. I thought it was a story about me and about scarcity, mine. Then, slowly, I came to realize it wasn't about me at all. It was about grace, God's extravagant grace, overflowing and abundant grace poured over my head, running down. Like oatmeal, it tasted good in my mouth and stuck to my ribs.
And when that foghorn blows, I will be coming home. And when that foghorn blows, I wanna hear it. I don't wanna fear it, and I wanna rock your gypsy soul.
I've been reading from my book, How the Light Gets In, a collection of short stories. I'll be rolling out two stories a week in the Mystic Cave through the summer months, and then returning to an interview format come the fall, where we'll be turning our attention to views of death and dying on the other side of Churchland. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch, you can write to me personally at mysticcaveman53@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Brian Pearson. This has been The Mystic Cave. But it's too